to a brief introduction to the Khazari, why I'm interested in teaching the Khazari, and methodological background statements about the Khazari, certain assumptions I'm going to make about the work, which will heavily influence the way in which I interpret it. The Khazari purports to be the record of an actual historical event. Yudalevi says that what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down the arguments presented by a certain Chacham, I think it's a Sofer of Yitzhak Al-Mangari, in a dialogue with the actual king of the Khazars. And in that case, you're treated that way, then we can't look for any kind of finesse or artistry or literary devices or anything like that, because after all, Yudalevi is just a scribe writing down what he remembers. That's one possibility. And this is really just a transcript several hundred years later of what actually happened with the Khazars. We do know that there actually were which did lead to the conversion of some percentage of the Khazar nation, although what exactly happened historically is lost in the archaeological record. But that doesn't mean, of course, the fact that the real event happened doesn't mean that this is actually the record of that event. Right? So one could take the opposite approach. One could say that, in fact, Yudalevi is using that as a device, as a literary device, which gives him certain advantages. It lets him use a dialogue for so long. And a dialogue is a very useful device, not just because it keeps people interested, but also to present ideas in certain ways which are interesting. And in particular, both the dialogue and the claim that one is recording a historical event gives you distance from the argument, right? If someone disagrees with the argument, you can point to them and say, well, okay, I agree with you, that wasn't a very good argument. But I had to write it down because that's what happened. All right, so the use of the dialogue and the claim of historical events is a way of giving the author distance, right, from his own work. And I would claim that the device Yudalevi utilizes very well throughout the Khazari. But I want to claim also that if one works on the assumption that the Khazari is a historical fiction as opposed to a historical transcript, that make one much more sensitive in general to literary devices. And I think I can show you in the introduction here that if one reads the Khazari that way, as a deliberately composed philosophic dialogue, as opposed to as a transcript, that a lot of things you wouldn't notice at first glance come out. What I want to do tonight is try and set forth what I think is the ultimate theory behind the entire Khazari. I think it's contained in the introduction. I say openly that this is, so far as I know, a fairly idiosyncratic reading. So I hope that you'll take close attention to see whether you agree with me or not. And I should say also that I set out to read the Khazari with an agenda. That at one point in my life I was a very anti-Khazari person. I found the book deeply objectionable for a number of reasons, one of which we can't get to tonight, which is, I think, also a common misunderstanding of his position about the uniqueness of Jewish people, which I think is often radically misunderstood. We can't do that tonight. But the specific reasons that we're talking about tonight, the specific objection I had is that people tend to view the Khazari as a book which at least believes itself to prove the truth of Judaism. Okay, and the fundamental argument that Khazari makes for the truth of Judaism, which is fundamentally boiled down to 600,000 people would lie, and 300,000 people couldn't be fooled, and nobody could make up a claim that 600,000 people saw something. Now, whether or not you think that's a good argument, okay, I certainly don't think it's a proof, although it has certain intuitive appeal. The question is, people tend to take that understanding that Khazari basically believes that any intelligent person would understand that Judaism is true, and that therefore, if you don't believe that, then you must be a fool, a charlatan, or worse. I tend to think that is a tremendously arrogant and basically untenable position. If one knows that extraordinarily bright people over the years have not believed in Judaism, I believe Judaism is true. But I think that a claim that one can prove it to the degree that anyone intelligent would realize it is really wildly arrogant. And attributing such an idea to Khazari, and very often people build such ideas off the Khazari, tended to make me unfond of the work. So we'll see tonight that I think that the Khazari says nothing of the sort. In fact, we'll see that the Khazari takes a position about it as extremely opposed to that as one can. Okay, that's good. They tip off where the thesis is going to go. So let me begin by reading the opening sentence. Okay, so Cesare says, you don't believe me, the author says, I have asked in my responses and objections to those philosophers and adherents of scriptures who disagree with us, as well as to the heretics who disagree with the Mass of Israel. I remember this argument. Okay, the other lady says he's going to respond to philosophers, adherents of other scriptures, namely Christians and Muslims, right? Hindus and Black Knight Giants are in the work. And the heretics among those who disagree with the Mass of Israel. Anybody know who that refers to? Karen. Okay, in fact, we have a letter from Yehuda Levi, in which he tells us that the point of the Cesare is to defend against Karen. Okay, all very well and good. Now tell me, when you read the whole introduction, which characters appear in the introduction? Philosopher, Christian, Muslim, no carrot. Okay, isn't that interesting? Right, a work which he tells you explicitly here is partially supposed to respond to Karaite, which he tells us in a letter is mostly designed to respond to Karaite. We don't have a Karaite. Okay, that to me is a fundamental question that you have to. Right, if you can't answer that, right, you can't really understand the book. Right, why can't he have a Karaite there? Now it might be he can't have a Karaite there because there was no Karaite. Right. So if you take it as a historical work, this is no question at all. On the other hand, if you take it as fiction, right, that becomes deeply significant. Now, I don't know what the historical record teaches us, whether there's a Karaite there or not. What is interesting is that in the middle of the Cesare, the Khazar king says to the Khazar, and you know what, I see that those Karaites are much more faithful to their religion than you are. So the Khazar king knows that they're a Karaite. But he never, for some reason, he never feels compelled to call them in. Okay, and I think that's a significant point. I should say that Leo Strauss, the great University of Chicago philosopher, argues that an even more significant in the work is the idea that the philosopher gets dismissed early. Right, because he sees the book as fundamentally an attack on philosophy, and his argument is that the philosopher cannot be allowed to speak for himself in any degree of seriousness because philosophy is too seductive. And if you let the philosopher talk for himself, you would win. And his evidence for that, though, right, is that you'll find throughout the book, every once in a while, the Khazar king jumps on the philosophic bandwagon. At least the philosopher will there. Okay, and there's evidence of that in the introduction. Right, because when the Khazar king responds to the philosopher, right, what does he say? Then he says, you know, your arguments are very good and nice, right? But they don't work for me because I got a drink. When he turns to the Muslim, he says, but look at me, I don't believe, right? If I don't believe that God speaks to human beings, how are your arguments going to convince me? And basically, he quotes the philosopher as the Muslim. Okay, as you see throughout the rest of the introduction, you'll see the Catholic king basically brought all the philosopher's arguments. Except he had a dream, that's going to be important too. I don't accept Strauss's argument that the philosopher isn't allowed to talk to himself for himself because he's too dangerous, and that the whole work is about that. But I think if you study the introduction, you study the way in which the Khazar king adopts the philosopher's arguments, and that tells you something also. Okay. Now I want to point out a couple of other things in the introduction. Particularly, I wanted to discuss the way in which the king reacts to the philosopher's arguments. Because it's a very personal way of showing what goes on between the king and the philosopher. The king tells the philosopher what, right? What drove me to this? What drove me to this? Why am I seeking everyone out? Because I had a dream. Good. Let's take a look at the end of what the philosopher says to the king. Okay, if you take a look at the end, that's on the second, the end of the first page, right? Yeah, end of the, on the bottom of the first page, right, the underlying section. Right, the philosopher tells him, right, seek purity of heart, perhaps it will, right, because if you attach yourself to the act of intellect, the philosophic ideal, perhaps it will imbue you with prophecy and inform you of the future in true dreams. Okay? Right, so the king says to the philosopher, I had a dream. The ending of the philosopher's speech is, well, if you do what I say, then you'll have true dreams. Okay, how does the philosopher start? He started by saying, you know what, your dream is false. Right, because what's driving the king is, I have a dream which he says, this angel comes to him and says, your intentions are pleasing, are desirable to God, but your actions are not. The first thing the philosopher says then is that God is above knowledge of particulars, so he doesn't know that you exist, let alone your intention with action. Okay, so the first thing the blocker does is head-on attack it. Okay, and then that insult injury, right, it says, well, your dream is false, the reason you came to me is false. If you followed my tactic, right, then it would say, right, then you would have true dreams. To which the king's response is, right, and this is on the second page, right, the king's final response is, right, according to you, right, this is section number 4, it would be appropriate that in the course of the deeds of the philosophers, with their actions, fidelity, truth, and striving, we would find prophecy known as found among them because of their attachment to spiritual, and the stories of great wonders would be told about them. Instead, we see that true dreams come to those who are engaged neither in wisdom nor in purification of the soul, and false dreams in those who are so engaged. Right? The king says, hi, you claim that I have true dreams like all of you. You guys have false dreams all the time. Okay. What that tells you is that fundamentally, the philosopher has no chance of convincing the king. Okay, the dialogue is set up so that the philosopher, right, the philosopher begins, right, the philosopher were, if we wanted to have a fair chance, right, the philosopher would say, oh, great and wise king, who has achieved wisdom through the dream, let me explain to you what it is that your dream meant and how it is you can attain the action which is pleasing to God. Right, having flattered him for 10 minutes, he would then start slowly to introduce him to the truth of philosophy. Instead, the philosopher's opening sentence makes it clear that he and the king are not going to communicate. Okay, at the end, it gets personal. Right, but at the end, which is entirely clear, the king's reaction to him is not at all based on his argument, the king is based on death. Alright, now the question is, however, right, if the point of this dialogue is to convince us, right, that in fact Judaism is superior to philosophy, right, so then it should be a fair fight, right, the king should look at a serious presentation of philosophy, look at a serious presentation of Judaism, and say, Judaism wins. But he doesn't. Right, so what's the point of the argument, right? What's the point of presenting the philosopher this way if he doesn't get a fair chance? Okay, that I think is also a central issue in understanding the nature of the two dollars. But it gets worse. Yes.
Yeah. But that what's going on is that the philosopher is saying that God is not really, that we are not relevant to God. And the king's response is, I'm sorry, I believe that we are.
Well, the king responds is, I'm sorry, I had a dream. The philosopher tells him your dream is false. What evidence does the king have that that's not true? How does the king know that his dream is true?
How does the king know?
Yeah.
Yeah, literally, yes. You're right. You don't know.
And so we stand here. Okay, right? This book is supposed to convince me. I don't have a dream. A philosopher demonstrating to me that God does not know particulars, and someone who has no credentials at all, right, claiming that he had a dream. Who should win? Okay. That's true, but we have no ground for rejecting philosophy based on this book. So the rejection of philosophy is a sham. It gets worse.
Right.
Let me explain why it gets worse. It gets worse because not only does the king reject the philosopher for bad reasons, he doesn't even understand the philosopher. Right? It's very clear to me that the king completely misunderstands the philosopher. Okay, what's the philosopher's argument? The philosopher's argument to the king is, you know what? It doesn't really matter which religion you choose, so long as you intend to purify your soul. Right? And if you intend to purify your soul, and right, then there are any number of strains of action which will allow you to protect your body so as to protect your soul. Okay, so the philosopher is a pluralist in that regard. Right? Because you can make up your own religion. Right? Or pick any of the philosophic religions, right, which would include Christianity and Islam, by the way. Right, because he thinks the right will claim the old philosophers will claim the founders of all religions are philosophers. Okay, the king thinks that all that matters is your intention, it doesn't matter what you do. Now that's completely false. The philosopher doesn't claim that it doesn't matter what you do. The philosopher doesn't claim, go out and kill as many people as you want, so long as it's for the sake of religion. No! The philosopher says that when you understand what the purpose is, there are any number of ways in which you can achieve that purpose. Right, and the king purports to reject the philosopher and say, you're wrong, because if you were right, how could there be two conflicting forms of religion? Ridiculous.
They're ridiculous.
The king's objection to philosopher is, what's going right? If there isn't an intrinsically desirable course of action, right, what do you say to Christianity and Islam, who divided the populated world between them? Right, they each have the right intent, yet they still kill each other. They can't both be right. Okay, they can't both be right. And the philosopher looks at the king and says, I don't understand. What are you talking about? Right, I believe that any religion, that the religion has to be intended to protect you. That a religion which involves killing other people who are trying to protect themselves is wrong. I never said, says the philosopher, that any action you do is right as long as you have the right intent. I said that it doesn't, that there's no specific action which is necessary. Right, so, right, any action which fulfills that intent is sufficient. Okay? So the problem is, right, to summon up the king, the king's rejection of the philosopher is really unserious in the sense that it's personal as opposed to argumentative. And secondly, it's right, the philosopher doesn't even get a fair chance to present an argument to the king because the king doesn't even understand it. Now, why does Newton Lincoln present a protagonist who misunderstands the argument? And isn't even willing to engage in serious we get to. But let me point out, it's not just the philosopher.
Okay, the Muslim comes in, right? And the Muslim says, right, this is a big argument in a lot of the voices. The Muslim says, hey, look, the Quran, that's a really beautiful book. The Quran proves its own truth. Because there's no way a human being could write a book as beautiful as the Quran. And by the way, this is a big fight, right? There's a lot of people who are supposed to come out of the desire to prove that you can write just as beautifully as Hebrew and Arabic. But even in the secular and in the historic, the religious point to it. The religious point is to prove you can do anything in Hebrew that they can do in Arabic. If you fail, the claim is to prove you're wrong, so it's a biblical story. What do I do? If I read Arabic, now what kind of argument is that? I mean, what do I do if I read Arabic? Right? It means that as bad as the king is as a philosopher, the Muslim's worse. Right, he doesn't get it at all. Okay, yes, ma'am. Which has no appeal whatsoever for people. Christianity never wins. Because people say that, wow, that makes sense. Right? No, friendship. There's a many different sense of Christianity in that. That's not one of them. The only thing that really, the thing that appeals to us is actually not the conversion.
Welcome. You've got mail.
Christians on the whole start by talking about things that work. Christians are good at you. This is why he's sensible in the whole book, is that he tells you that reason cannot prove anything.
Because he says, right, fundamentally his argument is, there is nothing I've ever heard as ridiculous as Christianity. Right, this doesn't make any sense at all. But he says, I'm not saying that you're wrong to believe it. Because if you have a Christian religion that's serious, so I know that reason can rationalize any powerful experience. Right? And so if you have a dream, right, in which a shiny woman in white appears to you, right, and says X, Y, and Z, so okay. Right, that's very powerful, right? Because if the book was supposed to prove to you the truth of Judaism, right, how can you make a confession like this? How can you concede to number one that reason never really proves anything? And number two, I'm telling you that I have nothing to say to a believing Christian. Right? So that's what he said. I have nothing to say to a believing Christian. Because if you have a powerful Christian experience, an experience in which you believe as deeply as I believe in my dream, there's nothing I can say. What it comes down to is fundamentally, it looks like the king is unjustified in his rejection of each of the prophets. When it comes to the Jew, okay, we don't have time to do a full presentation of the Jew tonight. Right, so the Jews are really fascinating, so I'm going to go through it rapidly. The interesting thing, the Jews start off by saying, I believe in the God, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The king says, wrong, you're supposed to believe in the Creator. Right, that's what everyone else said today. And the Jews give them the whole fancy themselves. Right, and again, I'd be happy at some other point to talk about all the flaws of Michelle. We're taking Michelle as good as for now. And the point of Michelle is that you have to believe in God the same way you believe in anything whom you had personal evidence, right, because he sent you a message. He sent you a message, right? You got personal evidence. Right, and he says, therefore, the reason I show it to you is, you see, I'm in Zion and not with creation, is because what binds me to the Torah is God taking me out of Egypt. Right, because that's the equivalent of the king of India sending me specific messages. I don't think it's true, but we'll get to why the kids are going to be in a moment. Okay, the king says to him, that's the final conclusion. Right, the king says to him, if that's so, then your Torah is binding only on you. So his response is, yes. Okay, I want to argue that that's the whole point of the story. Namely, the problem. Well, the advantage, right, and this goes the title of the work of the series of the disadvantages of reason, the title of the ninth year of Lenin's work, all becomes clear now. The king says, look, philosophy, Islam, and Christianity all make universal claims. Okay, if you study the sequence of each of them, they all claim to be binding on everybody. So, the argument is already is, anybody who makes a universal claim has to have universally acceptable evidence. Because the assumption of the book is that it wouldn't be fair to condemn people to eternal punishment or non-existence, right, if they don't have a fair chance. Okay? So he looks at the philosopher is rejected because he's argued precisely because he can't convince me. If you can't convince me, and you claim to be a universally true religion, then you're not. Okay? The Muslim and the Christian both claim to bind all human beings. Okay? If they claim to bind all human beings, then in order to be fair, they have to have an argument which convinces all human beings. But they don't. Because the Christian has an argument which doesn't work for anybody who doesn't have a Christian experience, and the Muslim doesn't have an argument for anyone who can't read Arabic. Okay? So what he says is fundamentally your argument might be very good, but the very fact that they don't convince me proves that they're not true. In your own terms, they might be true, right? They might be true points, but they can't serve as the proof of a religion which claims to be universal. Because a religion which claims to be universal has to be universal evidence. What makes Judaism unique is not that Judaism is their evidence, but that Judaism makes a form of claim.
Hi, Dan.
I claim that the only person who has to listen to me are people who have the historical experience of the Jews. Okay, the only joke he makes is he thinks that if you're part of a tradition, then it's as if you had the experience itself. Meaning that all Jews have the Kazar dream. Okay? So the ultimate argument of the Kazar is, I'm not talking to anybody who doesn't have a Jewish experience. Who doesn't have access to the Jewish tradition, such that, right, they would feel themselves, right, as part of that tradition as if they had the experience of Sinai. Okay? But, anyone who does, right, so experience is all the way through. Experience is the most powerful book. Alright, now it happens that when it comes to the Khazar, right, that the Khazar comes to Judaism because, right, everyone else the Khazar can reject. Because everyone else makes a never-ever claim. Judaism is the first person who makes the claim the Khazar could accept. So the people, now you understand why he can't have a carrot. Because the Karaites could make the exact same argument. Right, nothing he says in the introduction would have the slightest impact on the Karaite argument. So, right, so as you understand, you're already setting up the introduction. Right, so the introduction is that in principle, the only argument is experience. Okay, that suffices to get you, right, to get you out of philosophy, Christianity, and Islam. But Karaites, there is no basis for choosing between Judaism, between rabbinism and Karaism, except if you have enough of a Jewish experience that you end up buying a rabbinic experience. Okay, so I claim that the introduction serves to tell you fundamentally that truth is irrelevant to religion. Right? So the assumption of the Khazari is that religion can never overcome experience. Right? And the introduction just gets you out of all the other religions, right? In the rest of the book, it's where you have to respond to Karaism. He doesn't deal with it. My bet.
Universally apprehensible. And if it's fair for Judaism to oppose it. That seems to be the easiest way around that problem. I don't think, I haven't been through the whole book in a long time, but I don't think he addresses it explicitly. That would be the simple way.
Good point.
Yeah, sure.
What do you think
of
the
Jewish book in general? My book, but never really a direct response to terrorism. He has really interesting claims, and I have to explore it further. I know why he's not here. Okay, how he gets responded to the rest of the book, I haven't worked it out enough for the book in general. But yes, okay. He doesn't know what it is either. But he's not going to, right? What he doesn't say, right? What he says to the Christian is, I know that your argument is false because you claim universality. He knows, right, he has already seen that God speaks to human beings directly. Because he has a dream. Right, so he knows that. The Jews don't make any claim more implausible than that. That's the only implausible claim that they make. It's a relation, but it's not understanding. He's telling you that if I were a philosopher, right, who never had a dream, then the Jewish argument would be just as bad as the Christian. But I'm not a philosopher, I had a dream. No, listen again. They don't have, because they make rational claims for which, they make counter-rational claims for which they have no experience. But Judaism makes no counter-rational claim for which he has no experience, because the only counter-rational claim Judaism makes is that God speaks to human beings, and for that he has experience. And more than that, the others make claims which don't make sense to him and which he has no basis for believing. Judaism makes only one claim which he believes is unreasonable, and for that claim he has an experience. He does, he has a dream. He doesn't need experience yet. He has to try to prove it, to prove, right? If you're Jewish, the Jew says, look, but this is why I believe in Judaism. And the Khazar, right, the Khazar has no reason to believe in Judaism at this point. But he knows he can't believe in Christianity and Islam. Right, he can't do philosophy. Judaism is not counter-rational to him. Because Judaism makes no claim which make no sense to him. sense. That's true, Jim. Again, all they want is something that doesn't make sense. It doesn't have to make sense. It just has to not make sense.
But again, listen, the reason
isn't known to the Christianity, because Christianity claims the Trinity, which makes no sense, and incarnation, which makes no sense. Judaism only makes one counter-philosophic claim, revelation. And for that, it doesn't matter what his reason thinks, because he has the dream. That's why the subject has to have a dream. And it's right, the whole book is biased, right? Because it doesn't work for people who don't have a dream, right? So why is it doesn't work for them as standard non-Jews? So the Kaza has to have a dream, because the book's written for Jews. And if the Kaza doesn't have a dream, then he's not like Jews. Yeah. That's true. And that ain't work, Harry. But it happens to be that in the real world, there were no religions that made narrow claims. That doesn't exist till the late 19th century.
Why
you wrote the book then?
It doesn't work for all
time. No, it doesn't work for all time, except it's a really powerful presentation of the role of proof for religion. It tells you fundamentally. Right, that's the Kaza. It doesn't work for anyone but the Kaza. But for Jews, it works for all time. Right. It works for Jews, for Judaism for all time. That's all we want. It's not a book about conversion. It's a book for Jews. Right? This argument works for Jews. What doesn't work for us is for Jews who are raised as Christians. Right, that's the whole one of the things we have to work out next, right, is that why he makes it work for a Kaza or not for not just a failing Jew. The answer is because he couldn't persuade a Jew to lay any doubts about it. Right? A Jew had any doubts about the truth of Christianity as opposed to Judaism. He'd have no argument against them. Right? So he has to use the Khazar because the Khazar is the only person who would actually consider Christianity and Islam without having Christian Islamic experiences. Right? So what happens if you have other experiences? Right, but so the book is set up. No, it works for somebody who's Jewish and has a Jewish experience and wants to feel okay believing in a Christian philosophy.
For somebody who has
this
Jewish thought, possibly Jewish, possibly
not Jewish,
and doesn't have the experience that
engaged Jews. Right, that's what it works for. I don't know, I would argue that at this time, and even nowadays, it probably works for 96% of the Jewish population. Sorry, they only had it for a long time. You shouldn't follow this dream. Okay,
But I'm not interested. That's the question is how seriously you take the frameworks for Bernard and Fred. Maybe that's all of them, yeah. How's that angel? Maybe. I don't know. There's some people who want to argue that the end, that the really radical ending is at the end, the king agrees the philosopher was right, and that in fact the original dream was false. But that he arrives to trace their dreams anyway. I think that's right. But I think that's a little too fancy. Good. That doesn't make it so useful. I think it's very cool that a book which fundamentally argues for the impossibility of conversion without his supernatural experience, and is addressed to a convert. I think it's a cool phenomenon that he's a little bit on. But then we should send people home and go like, "Hey, maybe that's great." But no, for me, the important thing is that the Khazari fundamentally is really a very modern work in that it rejects the whole piece of the introduction and the insufficiency of reason, the irrelevance of proof, and fundamentally, the argument that in religious matters you can only convince people who are already convinced. But there's a value to that. And because lots of people who have the sufficient experience that they should really be convinced themselves, doubt their own experience. And actually, and the goal of religious argument is to confirm people in their own Jewish experience. Okay, thank you for the great audience to deliver.